Hello and welcome to Meet the Writers. I'm Georgina Godwin. My guest today is an award-winning broadcaster. He worked for the BBC, ITN and as an anchor of Sky News' early evening programme reporting on monumental events around the world, from Indira Gandhi's assassination and the Tiananmen Square massacre to the release of Nelson Mandela, countless wars, elections and military coups. He was the first person to broadcast live as British peacekeepers entered Kosovo. He also covered the Gulf Wars. He was in South Africa to witness Nelson Mandela's election as president. And his experience in journalism over 50 years is an absolutely fascinating read. He's won 3 Emmys, 3 BAFTAs and the Royal Television Society's Presenter of the Year Award and a whole string of other prizes too numerous to mention. Jeremy Thompson, welcome to Meet the Writers.
Thanks for having me. Very nice to be here.
Did you always know that you'd work in news? Where did that bug hit you?
Strangely enough, the date came up this week because it was the assassination of JFK on the 22nd of November 1963 when I was an A-level student sitting in a history classroom and the history teacher burst into the room and says, JFK has been assassinated. And as a teenager, I think it was the first big news event that really intrigued me, captured my imagination, shocked me. And I immediately found I wanted to know more about it. I followed all the events at the time, got hold of all the newspapers, saw the newsreels as it was in those days, and got rather excited about it. And I think it sort of lit that fuse of interest and curiosity in being a journalist. When it came to it, I had a bit of a battle with my dad, who had gone to work as a youngster in London in the mid-1920s when times were tough. So ingrained in him and all his generation was, get a steady job, son, get a pension. And he was in insurance and he was appalled that I wanted to be a journalist. And I remember him saying, do you realise, son, there's only one worst insurance risk than a journalist, and that's a jazz musician. I mean, it was kind of the bottom of the pile. So he was a bit horrified when I wrote off some local papers and managed to get myself an apprenticeship on the Cambridge News as a teenager, expecting really nothing more than to get through that and find out if I was good enough to get to Fleet Street. But I took a completely different course, as it turned out.
Well, of course, we know you as a sort of voice of breaking news, but you are a scribbler.
I was a scribbler who was, kicked out around the streets of Cambridgeshire and the villages of Cambridgeshire and the regional towns and expected to dig up stories and go to WIs and the local football matches and the parish council. And it opened my eyes and ears. I mean, it was a great training because I'm not sure young journalists get quite the same opportunities. There were no university degrees then. Mm. There was one year-long diploma course starting the year I went into journalism. It was at Darlington Tech, and 5 papers I wrote to say get a place on that, so I did. The 6th said come and have an apprenticeship, but that was it. One diploma course in the whole of Britain. There are now well over 100 degree courses in every aspect of the media, but I think what it means is that young journalists these days almost certainly go through that. They're wonderfully well qualified, they know how it all works, and then they go straight into a national newsroom of some sort. I kind of miss that, you know, pounding the streets and using your eyes and ears and meeting people and knocking on doors and digging up stories. The grassroots, if you like, which means that I think today you find a lot of newsrooms become a bit sort of sanitised processing plants rather than blood and guts old newsrooms.
Just on the subject of getting a journalism degree, why is it that media studies as a subject, particularly for A-level, but also going into degree courses, is really much derided in the working media world?
I'm not sure it's derided. It's just that it means that you rather take out the mix of personalities that end up in news. So all my generation kind of did it the long, hard way. And it was 10 years before I got into network TV, you know, and you learnt your trade on the way up. And I think it applied to most professions, to be honest. It was just a longer thing. Whereas now you know, there's almost a minibus wait and return from a university degree course to a newsroom these days. And I have met and worked with some fantastic young journalists who are, you know, I'm sure are going to be great. I sort of at times wish they had that opportunity that I did to get out there and experience life a bit and just get their hands dirty and their shoes in the gutter a bit and feel it a bit more, sort of Whereas nowadays, it almost feels like they're missing out a step. So I don't deride it. It's just a different way of doing it. And I wish people well. But it's gone from what my dad thought, poor, bit of a low-down profession, you know, trench coats and trilby hats with press stuck in it, to being a very fashionable and modish thing these days to be in the media. And youngsters, you know, coming into newsrooms in the last few years, some of them would, you know, you'd say, what do you want to be? And they don't say, I want to be a journalist. They say, I want to do what you do. And you say, well, what do you think I do? Mm. Well, you're on the telly. Mm. It's like, that's become more important than the being the journalist bit.
Yeah.
That I get a bit concerned about. I try and sort of say, well, you know, go ahead and please do some news, be a journalist, you know, get the bug, be excited, you know, feel the electricity when a big news story hits a newsroom. Then you'll be okay at telling people who are watching you or listening to you about that news with sort of credibility and energy and vibrancy that you need to get news stories out there.
Mm. So what was your route then from local papers onto network television?
Well, as a kid on a local paper in my teens and early 20s, I thought I'd go to Fleet Street. And really, most, you know, the likes of me and most of my generation didn't ever dream of a career in broadcasting. I mean, it was ivory towers, BBC and ITN, with a couple of hundred people working in it. So, I mean, there was no real path in there. And then local radio started up. In fact, this month, it's the 50th anniversary of BBC Local Radio. A friend of mine said there's a job going at Radio Sheffield. I went to BBC Radio Sheffield. So the southern lad ends up in the gritty north in the middle of the sort of death throes of the Industrial Revolution with miners' strikes and steel strikes and Arthur Scargill's flying pickets. And suddenly I was in broadcasting and learning the radio game and how to cut tapes and how to, you know, broadcast all through the night, how to do the sports show, the Sunday request radio show, the disco, the lot, as well as doing news. So it's an intriguing way in. Then I got spotted by regional television, went to Look North Leeds. And in about 10 years after I started in journalism, BBC decided they ought to have a network, North of England TV correspondent. And I was lucky enough to put in and get that. And that started what became 40 years in network television with three different networks.
Now, of course, one of the big stories happening in the North around that time was the Yorkshire Ripper.
Extraordinary story, the Yorkshire Ripper, and I was pretty much doing it on telly, on the local TV news in Leeds from the first murder right the way through to covering the trial at the Old Bailey nearly 5 years later and reporting on pretty much all those attacks. And I remember when I first became North of England correspondent having this, you know, this ridiculous row with the head of news, you know, the news editor at BBC in London, you know, who, it would be fair to say that, you know, the North of England seemed a long way from White City in London. And I remember saying, you know, shouting down the phone, how many do you want this man to kill before you get it on the 9 o'clock news? And it was one of those, well, you know, it's a very regional story, son. No, it's not. It's becoming a huge story. And I was trying to persuade them actually what this incredible reign of fear was like. You know, my wife and every other woman in the North of England was petrified. You know, they were frightened to go out on their own. You know, they'd either go out as groups or they wouldn't go out. I mean, it was that bad. It took a long time for the penny to drop at national level, newspapers, TV, radio, and so on. And then, of course, it became a huge story. And it was a very dominant home story in the late 70s. And eventually he gets caught in Sheffield. I end up in the Old Bailey covering the trial as the regional lad. So it got me quite a bit of good exposure apart from anything else. But it was an amazing story.
But then you made a what would seem to many as a very odd career decision.
Yeah, I was sitting in a courtroom in Middlesbrough doing a murder trial, which was a quite intriguing trial in its own right. And I was the BBC's North of England correspondent. Brent Sadler was the ITN correspondent next to me. And sometime during the trial, he said, hey, there's our sports correspondent job going. And I said, well, I fancy that. I'm very keen on sport. So I put in for it and got it. And all my friends at the BBC thought I was nuts. They said, you are crazy going to do. What are you going to do sport? And I, full of more bravado than real belief, said, oh, well, ask me at the end of the first year. You know, I'll tell you how good it was. Luckily, at the end of the first year, I was in the middle of covering an Ashes cricket tour. Brings back memories this autumn. In Australia, and actually on New Year's Eve, I was in a delightful swimming pool with a champagne glass in my hand overlooking Sydney Harbour and thinking, all's right with the world, I made the right choice, and all my mates back home were actually green with envy. Mm. So it was lucky it worked out. Like all my moves, I followed my nose and sort of quite often spun the coin and came up reasonably lucky.
And it was your coverage of sport that meant that you were holding a visa for India when, in fact, a big story broke there.
I was in the newsroom and the foreign editor shouted out, "Indira Gandhi's been assassinated. Anybody got a visa to India?" And I said, "Yeah, I have," because I was just about to cover a cricket tour. So off I went on the plane and covered the aftermath of Indira Gandhi's assassination, which had brought chaos to the streets of Delhi, fighting going on, big battles between the Sikhs because it had been two of her Sikh bodyguards who had assassinated her in retaliation for what they saw as an offence against their Holy of Holies, the Golden Temple in Amritsar. And so I ended up covering that, which was intriguing. I'd never been to India before. I'd never been to Asia before. So it's a big step. Then I got back into the cricket tour, and on the eve of the first test match in Bombay, the British High Commissioner, Percy Norris, was assassinated on his way to work the morning after he'd hosted a party for the cricket team. So suddenly I'd gone from sort of war correspondent in Delhi to crime correspondent in Bombay, did all that, then covered the test match, which had got delayed a few days, then was trying to get back to Delhi for the second test when Bhopal happened, the Union Carbide, terrible seepage of a poisoned gas cloud that killed thousands. And I ended up sort of with a local crew, camera crew, in the middle of this mayhem, people coughing and dying all around us. And I guess my first sort of, one of my first, you know, real man-made disasters. Extraordinary story. We spent a week or so there. And then I did the second test in Delhi, back to the cricket. So I'd been riots correspondent, war correspondent, crime correspondent, cricket correspondent, disasters correspondent, cricket correspondent again. And then I went off and covered the rest of the political campaign, which of course saw Rajiv Gandhi, Indira's son, not the anointed son, that was Sanjeev, but Rajiv becoming the next prime minister, and got the first foreign TV interview with him and travelled all around the country. So I then became a political correspondent and then did a couple more test matches. We amazingly won the series, somewhat against the odds. And a story which I'd expect to go out on for a couple of weeks, I came home 3.5 months later. It's which you did in those days.
Another huge Asian story was, of course, Tiananmen Square.
By that time, I'd set up a bureau in Asia, the Asia Bureau for ITN, based in Hong Kong. And so I was travelling extensively around Asia. I'd sort of got out to Hong Kong and then tried to figure out why ITN wanted a bureau, because it was the wrong time frame. It's very hard to talk to the desk in London. It seemed that they suddenly weren't quite sure what they wanted out of me. And then I stuck a map on my office wall in the back of my apartment and looked at it, and I realised that there was me on my own with a few agency camera crews, and I'd got a patch that stretched from the Khyber Pass in Pakistan-Afghanistan border to Hokkaido in Japan and Ulaanbaatar, the capital of Mongolia, outer Mongolia, that is, down to Rotorua in southern New Zealand. And I thought, whoa, man, what have you taken on here? You know, this is big. Anyway, some extraordinary stories came up. There were the pro-democracy riots in South Korea. There was Benazir Bhutto's election in Pakistan, which was groundbreaking in its own right. There was civil war in Sri Lanka. There were all sorts of things going on. And we were in Tokyo when we suddenly got this call that students would take the streets of Beijing. We raced in there and spent pretty much the next two and a half months in Tiananmen Square, getting to know the students well and feeling, you know, feeling the mood of China, or so we thought, and watching this extraordinary democratic uprising or attempt by the students to wrestle democracy from the vice-like grip of the Communist Party, which, of course, we thought we'd see it happen. And it was a very humbling lesson when the tanks rolled in and crushed it, and we were left thinking, well, actually, all the might of the foreign media did precious little to change history in this case. So it was quite a chastening story to cover, but an intriguing one as well.
Do you think that the foreign media can help to change situations?
Without a shadow of doubt, I think it can. And I was lucky enough to end up in your original part of the world, Africa, Southern Africa, and I covered many stories there, some which the media made very little difference in. But I think without a shadow of doubt, when I got to know Mandela pretty well, and he was an extraordinary man, the most charismatic and impressive leader I've ever met, and a man who called us foreign correspondents by our first names. And the very first day I met him, he would always call me Jeremy after that and ask how my family was. And he is a man with the cares of the world on his shoulders. Mm. But when I spoke to him a couple of times about it, he said, there is no doubt that you, the foreign media, kept the pressure on, kept the story alive abroad, which meant that politicians in the Western world, in the Northern Hemisphere, kept putting pressure on the old apartheid National Party government for many years. And he said, without that, it's hard to imagine that I would have got to this stage where I am negotiating the end of apartheid and hopefully the first full free democratic election. When I think, I was, you know, seen quite a lot of my old cameraman Ian Robbie, who I worked with for years in Southern Africa. He's now moved to London, and we talk about it quite a lot of those stories. I remember him telling me when I first went to and worked with him in South Africa that during the sort of 80s, he would quite often be covering the problems in the townships, the repression by the military and the police of any uprising inside of demonstration, and getting it on air and smuggling it out to get it on telly in Britain and the Western world. And he'd go home and friends, neighbours and family would call him a liar when he told them what he'd been doing, because, of course, it was censored on South African television, so it wasn't seen there. So they said, well, it's not happening. We haven't seen it on our telly. Why are you telling these lies? You're just a propagandist. Had a tough time, as did a lot of the other foreign media who were based there then. So that is an occasion where I think there's very little doubt that the media pressure helped gradually to create the atmosphere that brought about change in South Africa.
Mm. Now, this book highlights some of the biggest moments in recent history, but it's not all serious. And there's a wonderful chapter that talks about, of course, covering all of these stories, a huge amount of air miles racked up. You have a great chapter, ominously chapter 13, about flight frights.
Carefully numbered. Well, I should be aware, you know, the life of a foreign correspondent, which I was for many years, and then an anchor who sort of pioneered the idea of taking presentation out the field, meant I spent literally millions of hours, millions of miles in planes, all of which were terribly comfortable, or not all of which were airworthy at all. So I wrote a chapter that just described some of the hairy flights we had. Like, most people won't have been lucky enough to experience the corkscrew approach to an airfield. This tends to be when an airfield is in the hands of the people that are flying you, but they're surrounded by their enemies who are trying to take any flights out of the sky. So what you do is fly in very high and then go down a corkscrew funnel at enormous pace with your ears pinned back against the back of the seat with all engines screaming. And we went in there once to go and meet some guerrilla army in Angola that was one of many where we did the old corkscrew. And I must say, I mean, I was just white and sweating by the time I hit the ground and thought, how the hell did we come through that without crashing? And then there's another one, which is another chapter about going in to meet Alfonso de Clama, who was at the time one of the most wanted men in the world. He was running RENAMO, fighting the civil war after the Portuguese had liberated it and left it to the local people. And there was a long civil war between Frelimo and RENAMO, sort of left and right wing. And RENAMO had a pretty fearsome reputation for sort of eating babies and killing everybody in the bush and lopping off limbs. I mean, it was a lot of which, of course, was apocryphal, some of which was probably true. And I wanted to go and meet Alfonso de Clama, this enigmatic leader who was hiding basically in the jungles of the Gorongosa forest outside the capital, Maputo. And we had to fly, and we were told by anonymous sources to go to Malawi and hang about looking like tourists, and somebody would give us a ring. And eventually we were sent to the airport, Blantyre, and got on what looked like a disused lawnmower with a couple of wings stuck. It was shocking. And it had Pilots for Christ written on it. It was an old Rhodesian Special Forces lad who had found Christ and had invented Pilots for Christ and flew in and out and kind of acted as a taxi service for this right-wing crazy who was running RENAMO. So Ian and my cameraman and I ended up in this bone-shaking ride where we literally hedge-hopped into the Gorongosa Forest at about 400 feet and landed in an airstrip that you couldn't see until you were in it on a plane that, and the pilot saying, who's sitting behind me? Look at the hole in the floor. And I said, oh, yeah, there is a hole. Wind blowing up. And he said, yeah, that's where they shot at us last time. You know, it's one of those, oh, no. Anyway, we got in and out, and the most extraordinary thing is on the ground on my birthday in September 1992, we were being taken around on trials bikes, which was the way they moved around in the jungle, clinging on to two rather smelly generals who hadn't had a shower for many a long month, when the bike carrying my cameraman in front of me went over something that looked like a hose pipe that shot up in the air and then lashed at me, and I realised it was a six-foot-long black mamba that missed me by about that much. So a good bit of biltong and some malt whiskey cured that later. So the flight was just one of the things, the perils.
So many huge stories that sadly we don't have time to go into, but a lot of time spent in Africa with a lot of amazing things happening at that time. Of course, Kosovan War, you covered, plus many natural disasters, volcanoes and tsunami. You also covered the millennium twice.
Yes, it was an intriguing one. So I does that make me one day older than I really am or one day younger? I'm not quite sure. The boss at the time said, you'd like to cover the millennium from the other side of the world? I said, yeah, sure, I'll have a go at anything. So we flew to New Zealand and sort of stumbled out after a 24-hour flight and went pretty much straight to work and covered the sun going down on the last day of the last millennium across the South Sea Island, stunning stuff. Then broadcast all of it from Auckland Harbour, where there was a rainstorm all night, which meant the fireworks were a bit damp. Did all that, saw, you know, listened to Kiri Takanawa singing the dawn up on the beaches of Napier in New Zealand on the to bring in the new millennium. And then we wrapped up and raced to the airport, jumped on an Air New Zealand flight and headed east, put down in Fiji for the millennium bug. Do you remember that? When the whole world of techies, geniuses thought that the world was going to stop and every flight would fall out of the sky. So the pilot insisted we landed in Fiji. Nothing happened. So we took off again and we ended up in Honolulu back on the 31st of December and raced down to the beach where there was a live OB for me. And I did it all over again. So I did the sort of, you know, the sun going down, the fireworks on Waikiki Beach in Honolulu, the sun coming up on the 1st of January in this millennium. So I'd done it twice.
Fantastic.
So as you can imagine, we really didn't know one end of us from the other, didn't know what time of day it was. We went off to Pearl Harbor. There was nobody there. So we had a wonderful view around Pearl Harbor, ate a lot of nice seafood and then slept for about 64 hours, I think, after that.
Jeremy, you've met presidents and prime ministers, you've met royalty, you've met murderers. You've also met a lot of people who work in news, and you have a great chapter on presenters' tips, how to be a really decent news presenter.
Yes, and I still sort of try and pass it on more informally, but yeah, I think the key thing is not to try not to be something you're not. In the end, telly's pretty ruthless. It cuts through all the rubbish and it defines and spots who you are, I think. So the key thing I always thought was for the viewer is if they're to trust you, you've got to be yourself. So you've got to better look them in the eye and tell it to them straight. Tell them the story of the day. Tell them if things go wrong. Tell them if you don't know something. Tell them what you do know. But trust the viewer and have a conversation with them. Don't lecture them, don't hector them, don't shout at them, don't patronise them. Be your guide. I saw my role throughout from a newspaper junior to a network presenter as being a medium, being a guide, taking people to places that they want to know about, but they don't want to go to necessarily. You don't all want to go to a war, but you might want to know about it. So it's a great privilege to have gone through life. Somebody's given you the job of going out there and being the people's representative and trying to, and I just felt I need to tell it straight and fair and honest, impartially, and as scrupulously objectively as I can, it is not for me to make up people's minds. It's for me to furnish them with the wherewithal, the raw materials, the facts, I hope, of the story from all sides or as many sides as I can get to, and help them decide what they make of the world around them. So be yourself, talk straight, be honest with people, look them in the eye, level with them.
In 50 years in journalism, what do you think's been the defining story for you?
Oh, without a shadow of doubt, South Africa. To be lucky enough, I first went there to follow a rebel cricket tour in 1982 as a sports correspondent. Fell in love with the place then, warts and all, that it was. And to go back in the early 90s, I was when Mandela walked out of jail, I wasn't with him. I was with the ANC in exile in Lusaka and Zambia, where they were so disorganised, to be honest, that we, the media, ended up organising the party so we'd actually got something for film of them celebrating Madiba coming out of jail. But to follow him, get to know him, and see these, the turmoil and the turbulence of those few years in the early 90s through to the election that almost never happened in 94, to see him give his Rainbow Nation speech when I could almost reach out and touch him then, see all these world leaders coming to celebrate the dawn of a whole new age in South Africa. And I stayed on another year. I was asked to go and set up a bureau for Sky in Washington, and I said, yeah, but I really need to do this Rugby World Cup in 95, being a rugby nut myself, and because I also thought it would be a huge moment. And it was. It was almost the ultimate moment of that reconciliation that Madiba had been pushing for. And his charm offensive in bringing the nation round behind the Springbok rugby team, reviled so long by most non-whites, to bring the country to coalesce and to unite around the rugby team, and that extraordinary result was way, way transcended sport by 10, by factors of 10 and 100. And my wife and I were in, I was working, but I took her to the final in Ellis Park in Johannesburg and watched the Springboks win. It wasn't the greatest rugby match, but the moment when Mandela thought to put on Francois Pienaar's shirt and hand over the cap to, you know, a blonde, white African, the captain of South Africa, was an unbelievable moment. So those 4 or 5 years were extraordinary. And I've luckily got to know Pienaar very well. And I'm a director of his charity that we raise money to try and educate the leaders of tomorrow in South Africa and give another generation of kids a chance to come up and carry on the work that Mandela started that has perhaps faltered a bit in the eyes of some.
So finally, you're going from one very great president, Mandela. The last big story of your working life is a president of an entirely different stripe.
I can see what's coming, yeah. Well, I'd sort of planned about a year and a half out that a good time to finish would be my six American elections. I started with Clinton when I was based there in the 90s, seen Bush and then seen Obama. And then I thought, you know, let's do a sixth one. That'd be a great way to go out. They're usually exciting, pop backwards and forwards, follow the whole process. And I don't think many of us really thought that Trump was going to be a serious candidate. And it was an extraordinary year, an extraordinary story to cover, whether you like Trump or not. As a journalist, it was a hell of a good story. And I'd always said to people, sort of jokingly, well, I'd like to end my career with a bang rather than a whimper. And I have to say it was a bang, because when the votes came in and the nation suddenly realised it had voted for Donald J. Trump, it was the earth underneath us was shaking, but not necessarily for epoch-making reasons, but I think in, you know, sheer disbelief, really. But it was a heck of an election, an extraordinary one to cover, and one of those that, you know, people will always remember, like him or not, it was different.
Jeremy, thank you so much. All of those stories in much more detail, plus many, many more in this wonderfully entertaining and fascinating autobiography. It's called Breaking News. It's published by Biteback. It's by Jeremy Thompson, who was kind enough to come and speak to me today. Jeremy, thank you. You've been listening to Meet the Writers, thanks to the production team of Christy Evans and George McDonough. You can download this show and previous episodes from our website or app, from SoundCloud, Mixcloud, or iTunes. I'm Georgina Godwin. Thank you for listening.